CliffCentral.com.
That ended rather suddenly. CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. We are live from various locations all around South Africa. And we get across now to somebody who we've spoken to a couple of times on the show. She is a doctor, and we call her Dr. Robin. But this morning, she's here to talk to us about the lockdown, how that's going for her. And you can join in the conversation if you would like to on 0797482090. Hey, Dr. Robin, what's happening?
Morning. All good, thanks.
Are you all good? I mean, how's stuff going on? First of all, your practice, because you locked down with your family, right?
Yeah, currently I'm down with my family. It's been an interesting time. I have three partners.
Yes.
Each working one over the – sorry, I have two partners. There are three of us in total.
Right.
We're each working 1 week, and I'm due to work week three, which means that I'm very quiet at the moment and just getting bits of news filtering through. But it seems like the gynae world in East London is ticking over pretty much as normal.
Now, Pumi, first of all, let me compliment you on your excellent internet connection, because I thought the Eastern Cape, you know, we'd hear you.
Hello, world.
They've released extra thicky Gareth evening now.
Ekasa is working, actually.
Yeah, sure.
And we do have fiber and everything.
All right. Now, Robin, Pumi asked about you the other day. She's got some questions for you, but right up front, somebody asked the question today. I think it was Sia. Can coronavirus put a kid, a mom who's pregnant, can that child be at risk? And what kind of risk?
The work that's come out of China has been really interesting. They've been quite aggressive with their research subsequent to their peak in their curve. And it appears that pregnant women are not at higher risk of getting corona than anyone else. All pregnant women are slightly at higher risk for getting viral infections. But this one doesn't – it's so infectious anyway that it doesn't necessarily appear to be more infectious to pregnant women. And the really good news is that your risk profile remains what it would be if you were unpregnant. Relatively young, healthy women are getting pregnant. Therefore, their risk remains that of a young, healthy woman.
And what about newborns? Are newborns at greater risk?
Not particularly for higher, for worse illness. There have been cases of newborns getting it, and I think the earliest recorded case of a COVID-19 positive baby was at 36 hours. But they suspect that the baby contracted that from the mom after birth.
Okay.
But there's a six-day-old baby that died in America, isn't there?
I haven't seen that research yet.
Last week, the youngest case that they put out, 6 days.
Wow.
I'm sure that must be reassuring to a lot of women who were possibly panicking about it right now.
Yeah. No, definitely. I must say I've been able to really reassure some of my patients. Some of them are panicking anyway.
Yeah.
But, a lot of them are quite comforted by that news.
The side effect of being pregnant.
Is there anything under lockdown that would make it extra hard for a pregnant woman? Are there any things that she can't necessarily get? Are there any complications that might arise just because we're in lockdown that ordinarily wouldn't be an issue for a pregnant woman? I mean, patients of yours bringing some stuff up, for example?
I haven't had any specifics, but I have had patients really worrying about kind of accessing healthcare, and is it okay for them to come to the hospital, because my practice is based at the hospital, but they've quite rigorous screening and so I think we're good. And then the other thing I have noticed is that in lockdown, all the kind of obviously your clothing stores are closed, and your kind of things to access like baby clothes, if you unexpectedly had a premature baby and you weren't quite ready for it, you wouldn't be able to get clothes for that baby. You might not be able to get things like breast pumps and those sorts of things for the woman who's breastfeeding. But on the whole, most of the stuff that pregnant women or newly delivered moms would require, I think, have all been marked as essential. So,
they've revised the list for baby clothes. They've added baby clothes.
Okay. All right. Pumi, what did you want to ask?
Just, you know, so Dr. Robin, you're obviously reading a lot, being in the medical profession. Mm. What are the most fascinating things that have come out that you've read that we're probably not seeing in mainstream media yet?
So the one thing that Matt's now been chatting about has been a little bit regarding the BCG vaccine that we all had as as kids and its protective role potentially in COVID. And I actually this morning read an article. It's not from a science journal, unfortunately. So until it hits the science journals, I'm going to treat it with a little bit of sort of
suspicion, yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's the right word. And it says that there's a tenfold reduced rate of death in countries who do routinely give the BCG vaccine for TB as opposed to the countries that don't.
So which almost universally in Africa they were giving BCG,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Which maybe
exactly.
That's why
in India, they also give it, and this work sort of come out of the Indian subcontinent.
I've heard some interesting, again, conjectural information that we can't say is necessarily scientific fact. There's still not enough data about this, but malaria, you know, people who've had malaria, for example, and there are certain treatments for malaria that also seem to have some efficacy in respect of COVID-19. Again, this is very shady. It's in the gray, but this could go some way to explaining why countries that have had malaria are seemingly less likely to have the mortality rate of countries that do not have malaria. And maybe there's also a relationship there.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also those questionable links between the role of ARVs in the treatment of COVID. So,
And of course, youthful populations in Africa and India as opposed to other countries.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. How worried are you? Do you think this lockdown is working?
Last week I was feeling, when are we going to see the actual numbers? And this week I'm going, maybe we're doing something. I think once I hit the ground on Wednesday, on Thursday, which is when I start to work, I think I might get a little bit of a different view of what's actually happening on the ground. I think what we hear in the media is quite sanitized. And yeah, I mean, we've done over 50,000 tests, and you know, yet we're still under 2,000 cases. I think we're testing quite extensively, and I think those tests are about up with all the field workers now moving out. But I think we've done amazing work. I also looked at some modelling last night, and there was a fantastic model where if we do three consecutive lockdowns with about a five to seven day gap in between the three, we would absolutely squash corona in South Africa. Unfortunately, we would also have completely squashed our economy by then. So it's not really viable, and you have to kind of weigh up all your other things that you need to model into that equation.
Yeah, I've seen those graphs. who published those? Because, I mean, they've been all over the place. In fact, we even got a message on them today.
Okay.
Do you know who it was?
No, I can't remember.
And Dr. Robinson, from friends that you have in the profession, we know, we had this conversation at the beginning of the year with alcohol, like New Year's Eve being the biggest day for like trauma centers around the country. And with alcohol and the numbers coming from Bekele, what are people that you know that are in casualties in hospitals saying about how the kind of no alcohol thing is it working?
I haven't heard too much directly from my mates, but I do know that the only time that Soweto's Deep Sweat Mortuary completed its weekend's autopsies before Thursday of the week, were on two occasions in the bad old apartheid days, when the Soweto residents barricaded Soweto and the SAB trucks could not deliver alcohol into Soweto. And on those two weekends, no alcohol got into Soweto. And on those two following weeks, Deep Sweat Mortuary completed its autopsies before before the Wednesday, Thursday of that week. Yes. Also, know the other thing about alcohol is that it generally is sold in a glass bottle.
Yeah.
So you have your intoxicant and you have a weapon.
Wow.
All in
one.
My mates and
that.
I, when we met students, always used to fantasize about it not be sold in a plastic bottle, because then we'd have half the amount of work to do.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Well,
it
tells you about the character of South African society. And I think this is across the board because we have, you know, we have a drinking culture in South Africa. It's one of the few things that unites us. When you do think about rich, poor, old, young, black, white, it's a thing. Drinking is a thing. But maybe because of this and the enormous drop in mortality rates and in murders, among other things, perhaps we've got to face an ugly reflection in the mirror of what we really are. It's hard to think about these things. All right, Robin. Well, it's always nice to talk to you. And you'll keep us updated. And when do you go to work and get your hands dirty next week?
Tuesday this week.
Okay. All right. And your partners say they're okay? They've been more or less the same?
Ticking along. We haven't had any positive cases in our maternity unit. So for now, we're all good.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for clearing that up for us.
Sure. Right. Stay safe.
Good to
talk
to you.
You guys too. Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Robin.
Bye. Yeah.
There's Dr. Robin Spring, who is in East London, and she's currently locked down, but she's going to work, and she's just giving us a little inside track on what's happening in the medical community and, you know, in her own practice and the number of infections in South Africa. Let me just look it up quickly for today, see if there are any updates, because some people like to know this stuff, you know?
Yes, the update came out last night.
Ah, then we do have an update, and I'll tell you what that is in a second while it's loading over here.
And by the way, where do you get your updates? Because I heard a bit of a hoo-ha a couple of days ago about how Worldometer differs from this site and that site differs from that one.
I'm using the COVID-19 South Africa dashboard from datastudio.google.com, and it says 1,686 cases, positive cases, out of 58,098 cumulative tests. 10 people have been in ICU, 12 people have died, and 45 people have recovered. Average age of people, 41.8 years old. Median age, 40. Minimum age, 2. And maximum age, 85. And it looks like, according to all the graphs, we are flattening the curve.
So, yeah. I think in another 2 weeks or so, we'll have a bigger picture. Because I still don't think that, look, because our numbers are at any one time, like 3 weeks out, we're kind of looking at a dashboard that before is lockdown. Not a real-time picture. It's a before-lockdown picture. So hopefully in another week or two, the numbers that come out are numbers that are going to say, hey, we're making this thing happen. Because it's not like we're not – people are not going to get sick. We're just trying to not have everybody sick
at once
at the same time.
And I know in the greater scheme of things, this is not a big worry for people, but have you seen how they conduct the tests?
They stick a swab right up your nose, like almost into your brain. That's another reason that if I thought I had this thing, I wouldn't go near a testing center.
Really? Gareth?
I wouldn't dream of it. Not a chance. I'd get over it.
Can they not do it any other way?
Did you see – so speaking of Gareth saying you wouldn't go near a testing center, did you see the numbers that more men than women have come out positive?
Yeah.
So the numbers
– I wonder what that means.
Even in the mortality, right?
Yeah,
because guys wait longer. They don't, they you know, they feel iffy or whatever, and then they're like, you, I wouldn't go near a testing center.
That thing looks like they are trying to scrape your brain.
Right. I'm not in a hurry to have that done. No, thank you.
It's like an extended cotton bud or earbud. Ugh. And going up your nostril. Yeah. I mean,
undignified.
That looks so painful. I would far rather volunteer vein, get a blood sample, get a whole pint of blood if need be, but I don't know. That
they need mucus. They need mucus.
Mucus.
What a moist mucus. What's the ugly word?
All right.
No, I mean, it is a change. It is what needs to be done. So, sure, kudos to them for that.
Bulelo, you have a story for us about a 25-year-old tenant who is stuck at your friend And well, she slept over there during lockdown Thursday, and now she didn't have a car to get home. So now she's stuck there for the whole of lockdown with no clothes.
It's a ridiculous situation, right? So she's this young girl is a tenant of a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And she went to go, like, sleep over at a friend's house on the Wednesday night, right? So it had been arranged. She'll get a lift back with a person that was there. The next day, that other person went home. She didn't have a lift home. So the house is about 55 kilometers away. It's a She doesn't have a car. Right? So she said she tried to call her aunt, who refused to come and fetch her.
Wow.
And so now she's stuck at this couple's house. So the house is a couple. But here's the best part of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's stuck at a house where it's her ex-boyfriend's house.
Oof.
And the ex-boyfriend only found out now that she's the ex-girlfriend while they're stuck together in quarantine.
Wait, I'm a little
wait
confused.
Wait a minute.
I don't understand.
Who's the friend? Your friend?
So the tenant, so my friend is the landlord
okay.
of this young tenant.
Oh.
So my friend told me the story.
Okay.
Of the 25-year-old who, the night before lockdown, went to go and sleep over.
Who was the 25-year-old visiting?
Friends. So like they.
And that's just a clear friend, not an ex, not a friend.
Well, it's now subsequently come out that the friend's house, who it was, is her ex-boyfriend's house.
Hmm. Wow.
So she wasn't visiting her boyfriend.
You know, they were gathering as friends at the ex-boyfriend's house. You know, they've still got that friends, we used to date thing going. But the ex-girlfriend didn't know that this was the ex, that she was the ex-girlfriend. Now that news came out while they were, while this, the ex-girlfriend is stuck at their house.
Oh, this is quite
are they
simple.
All there in the same house together?
Yes, at their house. She's now stuck at their house for the whole of...
It's very simple. There's going to be a corpse that will be released from this body.
Can we get like a camera? The camera of all of the stuff that's happening.
Believable.
At the moment.
So basically in this house right now, there's the guy, there's the ex, and there's the next.
Current. So
okay.
That's yeah. Very, it's so complicated.
And she is, it's so hectic. It's so.
How many people are there besides the three? Just the three of them.
The three of them. And now it got revealed that your ex-girlfriend is now staying with us and now in my apartment.
No.
Horrible.
Girlfriend, I'd say to my boyfriend, if you love me, you will throw her outside.
It's hectic.
And let the army lock her up.
What, into the street?
Hectic.
And it's a girlfriend, not a wife.
Absolutely.
No, it's a girlfriend. And they only found out during like 2 or 3 days into the quarantine that this was my ex-girlfriend. And now she's here. She's stuck here now. She
but
couldn't get
she
home.
Came, under what auspices was she there? Were there other people on the
yeah,
night?
Yeah, so the night was like a dinner drinks thing. The guy who was supposed to give her a lift home, he just did a disappearing act before she was awake. And now she doesn't have a car. She doesn't have cash.
See, look at these the guests who don't know their place.
Would you,
and
know,
also, Mbulelo,
would you rather have someone?
Let's just rephrase this real quickly.
Yeah.
This is not, she, it's not that they discovered that they were exes. They kept it quiet. They kept it hidden away from the current girlfriend. So that is shady. If I was the current girlfriend, I don't trust both of them anymore.
That's my favorite part.
Horrible. Let me ask you this.
Alternatively,
would you rather
all
be trapped?
Just have a threesome.
Would you? Yeah, well, I mean, Pumi, you're very open-minded, you know, and a lot of people are not as open-minded as you.
There's lots of time.
That's why that guy wanted nudes.
You know, yeah, the guy wanted nudes from Pumi this morning. That's great, Casey. Pums, would you rather be trapped with someone you don't want to be trapped with in a house during lockdown, or have handed your phone in for repairs just before lockdown and then didn't get it back in time? Those both give you anxiety.
Trapped with someone.
Trapped with someone.
I'd rather be trapped with someone. Yeah. You can ignore someone.
Mm.
Without a phone, you can't, like, what are you supposed to do? You know, can't keep yourself all that occupied. You're cut off from the world. But if you're trapped with someone, you can just ignore them.
I think you're good. I'd probably choose that too. All right.
This is why I had a thought the other day, and I'm so standing by it right now. Can the government feel pity on us and just give us not even a full day.
24 hours.
24 hours. Just give us 3 hours to change locations. I think, you know, we've had a first
like
stretch.
Like musical chairs.
This can be seen as the experimental phase. Some of us made mistakes. Just give us 3 hours to change locations.
People have run out of alcohol stock.
And I think they should just let it go. Exactly. You know, let's open it up. Let everybody get their shit together, because some people didn't. And then you've got, again, you've got another 3 days of lockdown, then they break it again, then 3 days. Because then you could even have, you know, the opportunity of maybe trying out a visitor. Or maybe staying with a family, and if it doesn't work, you've only got 3 days, and you can get back to normal.
Okay, but to Sia's point, what happens if you live in a one bedroom apartment with your girlfriend or boyfriend of 6 years, and you break up now? What happens then?
Exactly. If you try the 10 days, what day 11 now, and then you guys have broken up, then they give us the 3 hours. We're going to different places, and you get to. And you accept that you've broken up and you move on.
You just bite the bullet, man. You just bite the bullet. Don't be such wusses. Just bite the bullet and live through it. You know?
Yeah. Get it up.
Pick it out.
Yeah, some people have got real problems.
For 6 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You've lived with this person for 6 years. You can live with this person for another 20 days.
I agree.
Fair enough.
Stop being such a weasel.
20 days, those are 60 meals, those are afternoons together, that's 20 nights of hearing them snore, that's 20 days.
It's a lot.
It's
a lot, because I've seen people's responses just to someone thinking that someone else is sliding your DMs. Now they find a DM message, and now it's a lot.
I think
I think this is the time when people learn to grow up. Get over yourselves. Get over the little things, right? Get over the fact that it's the ex-girlfriend. Just, like, find another way to live through it.
Get over it.
Yeah, she's right. Like, you think you got real problems? Like, there are people out there with real problems. And you are not...
You guys would be calm with something like this?
Well, like Pumi says, you can ignore each other. You can, you know, you can be in the same space, but you can ignore each other. There are people who work in big office buildings who've definitely had relationships, and they manage to avoid each other.
You don't even have to talk to that person. You don't have to talk to them.
Let's assume
one-bedroom apartment where you see
exactly
on the couch.
All right, listen, I want to get to Danny Kaye. We've got to talk to him because Danny's got some interesting stuff going on. He's got a huge commitment to South Africa with a new arm of his organization, SHOUT, and he's launched a campaign to help raise money to buy masks for healthcare workers and patients. I think it's a terrific initiative. Pums, your connection has deteriorated, so I'm going to let you go, and we'll chat to you next week, Tuesday.
Bye-bye, guys.
Enjoy your baking.
Thank you.
I'm off to make a chocolate cake.
Very good. All right.
Duty calls.
Sounds good. So we're going to talk to Danny about SHOUT for Masks. You know, he started SHOUT SA. They've partnered with SMD Technologies, a private company, to help raise funds for the SHOUT for Masks campaign. It's, according to its founders, enabling all South Africans, including corporates, to make donations of combo packs of both specialized and surgical masks to healthcare workers and patients urgently in need for only 100 rand. SMD Technologies has secured deals directly from factories at cost price with no middlemen who are profiteering in between. And I think this is a great initiative. So well done to Danny. We're going to speak to him in a second about that.
Yeah, right. The thing about Danny Kaye and Kabelo as well, when they get working. You know, SHOUT has been around for years now. And yes, it started off with the big campaigns and the song that came with it. And we thought maybe it might just be a fleeting thing. But they were very committed to education and making a difference there. And years after the fact, they're still at it. And even with something like this, SHOUT for Masks, I was just looking at Danny's social media. There was one company who donated R250,000 already. And then two other companies who've donated 25,000 rands each. Like, this is going to make a world of difference to people.
Yeah, and these masks are a big thing, hey? I mean, you remember they said at the beginning masks were no good and didn't really do much. Now it turns out that they might be essential, not just for healthcare workers, which is what Danny's getting them for, but even for ordinary old us. Those droplets in the air. I saw a revolting, revolting video.
Oh, no. What was it?
At a university in Japan, they did some tests, and this video shows this guy sneezing. And you see the droplets. It's revolting. You see these little droplets of snot and viral infection, and they fly through the air, and they show it in infrared and in ultraviolet, and they can tiny little droplets. It's disgusting.
Boy.
Yeah. Horrible thing to deal with. God,
okay, we need masks.
Need masks, people. So how are you, Danny?
Morning, Gare. How are you?
Nice to see you, dude.
You too.
And congratulations on what you and Shout are doing here for healthcare workers. So I explained to everybody, you, along with SMD Technologies, have got these deals from factories where there are no middlemen who are profiteering, and you're able to help healthcare workers get their masks. Because we know there was a shortage. What brought this about, and how did you see a gap to get involved and make a difference?
It kind of fell into our lap, I guess, because SMD were, you know, commercially selling masks, mm-hmm. and I'm very close to their managing director, and we just had a chat one evening, and I said, you know, how's business going? And he said, well, he's one of the few businesses as an essential service that's operating and actually doing well by supplying masks commercially. And the more we spoke about it, the more he got a sense of wanting to try and give back, you know, from the opportunity that's fell in his lap, because he never sold masks before, but he found himself selling them. And I said, well, why don't we do something at Shout where you make zero margin and we give, you know, the masks you're bringing in from around the world to healthcare workers at cost. So we let the public donate. Mm-hmm. The public's money can go really much further than going to Dis-Chem or Clicks and buying masks for doctors, because, you know, there's margin on those masks.
Right.
He agreed. We phoned our friends at Network BBDO, who's Shout's creative agency. And in 24 hours, they put this most incredible website together, calls to action, and we were up and running.
It's amazing. Have you seen a nice response from people since you've launched? You've obviously been talking in various media outlets, and you've put out your own press releases about this. Are people coming to the party?
Yeah, so we raised, we literally, from a blank sheet of paper and no one knowing about this, we raised about 450,000 Rand in 24 hours.
Incredible.
From the public and now corporate South Africa, which I think we'll see our biggest donations have started, you know, coming in. So we got a donation from cars.co.za for 250,000 Rand, Sonic mattresses, 50,000 Rand. So it's like starting now. But doing things like this, I think, will further amplify the, you know, the campaign.
All right. How can we get involved, whether we're small individual, you know, people in society wanting to make a difference, or you're a big company, maybe you're the CEO or you're the marketing director, and you don't have, you know, now because of events being canceled and activations, you've got some budget that's been released. You can maybe put some of this to good use. How do we get involved?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, it's a great question. I think both corporate and, you know, sort of active private citizen alike can visit the same URL. It's Shout4Masks with the number 4, M-A-S-K-S, masks, .co.za. And we've got different packages. We've got a package of 7 masks for 100 Rand, which comprises of 3, we call them like medical-grade masks, things like N95s, FFP2s that the doctors and nurses should be wearing. And then surgical 3-ply tissue masks that you and I suppose, could wear. That's $100, pack of 7. If you go look at prices in the market, you'll see that for a 7-pack of masks, you know, that value is kind of unheard of. That's the cost-price benefit from SMD. And on that website, you can buy either a pack for 100 Rand, or if you're a corporate, you can buy a silver, gold, and platinum package ranging from, I think it's 25 to 250,000 Rand. You get a Section 18A certificate back, so you can get the tax benefit of your donation. And, Yeah, I mean, you can buy as many packs as you want. I think you can donate 500 Rand. We've seen people donating 1,000 Rand. And those masks will go directly to, you know, flattening the curve, going to the doctors that need them. And the interesting thing I've learned about these masks, you know, everyone's become a medical expert over the past
years.
Yeah, much to my parents' disappointment, I'm not a doctor. Jewish parents. you know, these masks do not exist forever. You know, they have a lifespan. So, like, your typical surgical mask has a four-hour lifespan, and your medical-grade mask has about a 72-hour lifespan. So these doctors not having enough supply in hospitals treating COVID-19 patients actually really puts them at risk, because they need to keep recycling these masks, you know, getting new ones on them. So there's an enormous demand and a huge undersupply.
I think it's so good that you're doing this, and congratulations to all of you. Where are you under lockdown? Are you in Joburg?
I'm in Joburg, yeah. I'm at home with the family.
How's everybody?
Yeah, you know, it's been challenging, but I'm not going to complain about my northern suburban privilege. You know, there's people far worse off than I am. I'm just trying to channel my energy into, you know, doing things like this.
Are you in your study or your wine cellar or in your bowling alley or in your cinema?
I'm in my study makeshift gym, which happened the day before lockdown began, when I heard, you know, we weren't running on the roads anymore. So, yeah.
Have you and your wife had a fight yet during lockdown?
Of course.
Yeah. All right. And
without missing a beat, he was honest about that.
I always like to speak to him, and maybe we must get him in for Living in Lockdown. It's a new series we're doing at the moment. But I love your father's take on everything, because he's, first of all, he's one of the most saintly people I've ever met in my life. He's just full of good and positivity. How's he interpreting this madness around COVID-19, your dad? What's his wisdom? Share it with us.
My dad is an insanely positive person, regardless of what's happening in any of our lives or the world. So I think I get kind of my sense of optimism from him, certainly. You know, he's always upbeat, and I think one of the things that I'm figuring out about your state of mind during this time is that if you watch too much of the news, if you get bogged down in all of these graphs, you know, all of us also become graph-reading experts.
Suddenly everyone's a statistician as well.
A statistician, exactly. You know, you can freak out, and I think the nice thing about, you know, my dad and especially both of my parents is that when we speak to them, or they're speaking to the kids, whether it's on Skype or Zoom or whatever, it's a lot of happiness, a lot of optimism, and just trying not to get, you know, bogged down by the doom and gloom, the financial stress everyone's, you know, under, the country's stress. Because it just affects your morale, you know. I think you need a high morale to get through these days, and these days, you know, are going to get tougher. Like, I think week one was kind of like honeymoon period. Everyone's at home, you know, like enjoying the little mini holiday. But as the weeks roll on, and if lockdown's extended, I think our state of mind is going to be important. So my dad helps me stay positive.
Yeah, he's terrific, Gavin Koppel. We must talk to him, Sia. He's usually the kind of person to uplift.
Nah, he would love to be
the rest of us.
He would love to speak to you.
All right, and are you connected there? Are you speaking to a lot of people, doing a lot of Skype meetings and so on?
Yeah, I mean it's just been unbelievable the way the world firstly changed and then adapted very, very quickly. You know, I never did many Skype meetings, never interacted in interviews with the media via Skype. Now, you know, I'm on TV with this thing, the news, everyone's like, it's just adapted, which I think is probably a good thing, especially for this campaign, that we can still promote and get the message out, yeah.
Well, well done, and congrats to Shout for making a difference. You guys are always at the forefront of kind of trying to do something positive for the country, and I think many of us appreciate that. So thanks, Dan. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Gareth. Cool. Thanks, Sia. Thanks
keep,
for having me.
Keep healthy and keep safe.
We'll try. And you. Bye, guys.
Lovely. There we go. Awesome. Danny Kay. I was gonna make him sing for us, but, you know, it's not fair. He's doing enough.
Gareth, if you always want someone to sing, I'm here.
All right, very good. So if you want to find out more...
Did you ignore that?
Oh, please. What are you talking about?
I can also say, shout.
Oh, shut up.
Let it all out.
Yeah, we had you sing. I ended the show yesterday early because you started singing. Don't make me do that again.
Well, we are about to go to Blind History.
Yeah, actually, let's get to Blind History. So this is an episode of...
Blind History.
Stop it.
Gareth's favorite stop person it. In history.
Sia, stop it. Ooh. You're ruining everybody's day. Stop it. Right. Blind History, followed by an episode of Living in Lockdown. Now, we have a few really cool episodes for you this morning. It's Tumi Murake is on the lineup. We also have Rabbi Yossi Goldman today. Rabbi Yossi Goldman is the rabbi for Sydenham Shul. And, of course, we're going into Pesach, so the Jewish community are getting ready for the Yontav of Pesach, which happens from tomorrow, I think maybe tonight.
And Wednesday evening.
Is it Wednesday evening? Okay.
Yes.
So you can check in with Rabbi Yossi Goldman. Interesting conversation I had with him. First of all, very inspiring discussion, but also somebody who is finding new ways to communicate with his congregation. So you want to hear about that. And, of course, Easter's coming up this weekend, too. Now, we will not be live on Friday or Monday morning because of Easter. And, you know, it's just too much for us to roll out of beds and do the show like we have every other day. So we're not going to do it on Friday or on Monday. But because it's a holiday, a lot of people won't be doing anything on those days either. But we have tons of podcasts for you to listen to. And I mentioned it already, but my favorite episode of Blind History in terms of the people we've covered, perhaps no other single human being has had such a lasting and powerful effect on the idea of civilization. For his long reign, Augustus mostly wanted to be called first citizen, but in effect, he was one of the most powerful men to ever walk the earth. He instituted a period of peace called the Pax Romana, which is something that was unknown in the ancient world, which was a brutal place. He made laws, he elevated culture, he commissioned public works, and he vanquished every single one of his enemies, including Cleopatra. By the time he died, he had brought about the creation of the greatest empire known to man at that time. No small fry. Emperor Augustus Caesar, next on CliffCentral.com. Two bronze pillars stand in front of a round mausoleum, shaped like a man-made mountain, ringed with trees. Built inside Rome's Campus Martius in the year 14 AD, this is the final resting place of Rome's first emperor. The inscription reads, "In my 6th and 7th consulates, after putting out the civil war, having obtained all things by universal consent, I handed over the state from my power to the dominion of the Senate and people of Rome. And for this merit of mine, by a Senate decree, I was called Augustus. All of civilization owes him thanks." Blind History, Season 3. I have to admit, this is an episode I've been waiting to do from the very beginning. This guy is probably my most favorite person in all of human history.
John, that's saying a lot.
Yeah, and I've studied everything I could possibly get my hands on around him. From when I was a little kid, I was just fascinated by this man who had, roughly at the time of Jesus, become the first emperor of Rome. He reigned from 27 BC until he died in AD 14, and he was the founder of the Roman Principate. He consolidated an enduring legacy as one of the most effective and controversial leaders in human history, and without a doubt had the biggest role to play in the foundation of Western civilization from that point on. And I don't think that's saying too much. He was also made a god by the end of his life, something that most humans can only aspire to.
I mean, but everything he said is so true about him. He was just phenomenal.
So Augustus wasn't his real name.
Octavian was his name from birth, and when Julius Caesar adopted him, then he brought the name Julius Caesar Octavian. Mm-hmm. But then Augustus came 7 years into his reign, and he never had dictatorial names of any sort. But the Senate decided to impart him the name Augustus.
Yeah. Which meant the
revered one.
The highest one of all. It was actually, there was a part of what it meant to be emperor that was connected to the Caesar part of it, which came from Julius Caesar. But there was a part that was related entirely to Augustus, which meant actually being in charge.
Mm.
And every emperor from then on called themselves Caesar Augustus. But this guy, his shadow is cast across all of time. Because he built an empire which lasted for 500 years and which influenced all the empires that came after it.
Correct. Nothing's matched the Roman Empire.
No.
Since. And if we look at the four emperors after him, all related, there's been so many, but none of them
matched him. No.
Truth be told, he was extremely intelligent.
He was extremely, extremely clever. From an early age, I think Julius Caesar saw that this little grandnephew of his, the son of his cousin Julia, that this kid was exceptional. He was sharp as a knife. He read politics. He studied philosophy. He went to Greece. He learned how to fight. He learned in a Machiavellian way to manipulate people around him and to get the very best out of everyone who worked with him. I mean, he grew up as a patrician kid, but he wasn't overly spoilt. His mother had had an affair with Mark Antony, who was Caesar's great general. And really, when Caesar died, he should have named Mark Antony as his heir.
And why did he name Octavian or Augustus? Because Caesar must have been blown away by him. And in the beginning, he was also quite sickly growing up. And Caesar called for him in one of the campaigns in Africa, and he couldn't come because he was sickly. But then he came for one of the Spanish campaigns, and he joined Caesar in many of the battles.
Yeah, and he put himself at great risk, personal risk, even though he wasn't the strongest of kids. And he did have two compatriots who he traveled everywhere with who were also fundamental to his establishment of the empire. Agrippa, who would eventually marry his daughter Julia, and Maecenas, who was really the father of Roman poetry, a great patron of the arts. And between the three of them, they managed, always with Augustus at the top of the triangle, they managed to make a state that is about as close to the ideal of one person as can be achieved in human history. He also expanded the Roman Empire during his reign to its furthest reaches. There was a period of peace unparalleled again in the ancient world. The Pax Romana, which later was called the Pax Augustana. But He was a very moral, very principled man, sometimes to his own detriment. He expected everybody to be virtuous.
Even his daughter.
And to be honest, and we'll get to his daughter in a second, because that was a major disappointment in his life. He married a woman called Livia, but he first had a wife called Scribonia much earlier than that. That wasn't a very successful marriage. And when he saw Livia at a party, she was already married. And he arranged, because he was already powerful enough at that stage, to have her divorce her husband Drusus and marry him. They were happily married by all accounts until he died.
Yeah. She was very loyal to him. There's stories and there was a TV series, I, Claudius, about her poisoning and eliminating rivals. So her son and the stepson of Augustus,
Tiberius,
to take control. That was sad because he was useless.
He was useless, but Augustus managed to reform the state. He created laws. He organized the military.
He built roads.
He, in his own words, said, "I inherited Rome brick and left it marble." And much of what we know about the great classical period is that period of his reign.
And the postal service.
Absolutely.
That was him during his time.
Yeah. Little things that we take for granted in modern society today come from Augustus.
Yeah.
And he never liked to get the credit for any of this stuff, although he knew ultimately he would. And in his will, he doesn't really mince words about all the things he achieved. There used to be, in the place where he's buried, the mausoleum of Augustus, two pillars which recorded all of his achievements, and they could barely fit them on there. But the guy had a dislike for any symbols of kingship. He would always wear just a toga and sandals. He would never wear the imperial purple. He didn't like to be revered as anything near a god while he was alive. Although, secretly, there must have been a huge ego that was hiding under that toga, because he
liked the idea of Julius Caesar being a god, and he liked people to know he was the son of a god.
Yeah.
He took Julius Caesar's name at the first opportunity. Mm. He took his inheritance from Julius Caesar at the first opportunity. He destroyed any opposition to his rule. First of all, from anyone within the second triumvirate.
But I think that's important to say, well, how did he go from being the great nephew to being the first emperor of Rome? And it was actually very, very hard, because at the time of Julius Caesar's death, I mean, Rome was just thrown chaos. Into chaos, because he was murdered at his heart. And what transpired after there was phenomenal, because he had Marcus Agrippa was an incredible general and his close, close friend. And together they took out Mark Antony, and then they decided not to finish it off, and they brought him into the triumvirate because it served him. Mm-hmm. At that age, if you think between 1718, 1920, he managed to take control of an empire.
He had people like Cicero eating out of his hand.
Correct.
Cicero, who was this great orator, this politician, this spokesperson for the people.
Mm.
And he managed to get the patricians and the plebeians on his side.
Yeah.
He also managed to get taxation right. He managed to bring bread in from Egypt so that the people weren't hungry. But there were cracks, because eventually he and Antony were not friends.
Mm.
So how did the relationship between him and Mark Antony devolve?
Well, originally he wanted to take Mark Antony out right in the very beginning. Then he said, no, look, I need him, because he had a very, very strong following with the army. And this is where he was strategic, in that he knew he needed him to be able to take control of Rome. So that's why they brought together a second triumvirate, which included another very, very able
Lepidus.
But he never liked Mark Antony. I think he was just biding his time. And Mark Antony was very unstable. In the end, he was married to Augustus's sister, and he just dumped her and just left her adrift while he went cavorting with Cleopatra. And there's a lot of things that really upset him, because at that time of the triumvirate, the second triumvirate, they split Rome into three for the three of them. And you could see that wasn't going to work. So that didn't last very long. And then what he needed to do is he needed to clean it up, and he cleaned it up very quickly.
And he wanted to take it all under his control.
Correct.
And he didn't waste too much time. He eventually took on Antony at the Battle of Actium, which was part a sea battle, part a land battle, and humiliated and defeated him completely.
Antony had 10 times as many warships from the Egyptian fleet, but the sea was quite choppy at the time of the battle, and he had small ships, and they completely routed them. And when Antony saw this routing on the wall, him and Cleopatra gapped it. They managed to get through the battle, and they went down to Egypt. But then Augustus ensured that he sorted them out.
Yeah.
And Mark Antony half-heartedly committed suicide, but he didn't quite do it, and he was bleeding to death, and they took him to Cleopatra. And then he died. But the story of her dying next to him with a snake bite, committing suicide, isn't altogether true, because she went to Augustus. And this is to your point earlier, Gareth, is that he could be ruthless. And she went to him and tried to do the alluring charm that worked on Julius Caesar, and it worked all the way with Mark Antony, and he just said no.
He was cold as ice.
Cold as ice. So she committed suicide, which is what you needed to do when the game was up. And then Augustus ensured that Julius Caesar's child with Cleopatra was killed.
Caesarian.
Correct. And then the two children she had with Mark Antony. So he killed all of them. And then he took everything and any history that related to Mark Antony away in Rome and all around the different regions. And that's why it's actually quite hard to find
coins of Antony,
and busts
and
all of those things of Mark Antony, because it was completely cleared out by Augustus.
Well, he wanted to write history, and he wanted to write his own story.
Mm.
And you can fault him for many things, but he hasn't left us with much option. And there are statues to him, almost more than any other emperor. They keep finding all kinds of interesting things about Augustus now, which tell us a little bit more about the character of the man. But as I said earlier, he was principled to a fault, and he didn't look very kindly on his own daughter, Julia, who he thought was immoral. She didn't exactly do herself any favors either. She's supposed to have prostituted herself to a whole lot of rich men in Rome. She's supposed to have been very licentious and difficult to reason with. I think probably just the force of this incredible father of hers made it impossible for her to live her own life. She was married off here and married off there, and she was really just an accessory to him.
Sadly, he excommunicated her. He sent her to an island, and there's not much more about her in history.
She was the ultimate heir, even though she didn't live to become empress, because her whole family kind of were the Julio-Claudian dynasty and were the only relatives of Julius or Augustus Caesar. And they lasted three or four generations, and then they were all extinguished. And the women in particular had terrible lives.
Yeah.
Exile, murder, mothers turning on sons, sons butchering mothers, sisters being sent off to remote islands, horrible things.
But I think the Livia Drusus lineage, you know, you look at lineages and it's just unfortunate that this particular lineage, I think there was a couple of tools missing in that shed.
Yeah, some mental health issues, yeah, to say the least. Livia, though, was an extraordinary wife to Augustus.
Yes, no, there's no doubt.
And all those rumors about her poisoning him, I mean, he lived to a very ripe age.
They found that eliminating any opposition to Tiberius becoming emperor, that was also there, but none of it's been proven. I know it's hard to prove.
Augustus's great misery was that his daughter was such a mess, and that his grandsons, who were meant to inherit from him, Gaius and Lucius, also died before he had died.
And that was around the time that that Teutoburg Forest, they got absolutely routed by the Germans.
Yeah, that was a very big disappointment to him too. That was his only major military loss.
Yeah.
But Augustus died in peace. He was unique almost in that he got to die in his bed at his villa in the country in Nola. And there's a famous story about how his last words are recorded. We have no reason to not believe them. That he was lying in bed, and there was a room of people assembled around him, and he said to them, "Have I played my part in this play we call life well?" And they all nodded and went, "Yes, Augustus, yes, Augustus." And he lifted his head one last time and said, "In that case, applaud," and put his head down and died.
Yeah, that's in every autobiography I've read that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Could any of us wish for more?
No, he lived his whole life on his terms.
When he was eventually cremated, one of the senators who was present said they had seen his spirit rise into heaven, and they declared him a god about 10 days after his death, and therefore he had achieved everything and more than he wanted and that he'd aimed at as a child.
And Augustus being August.
Yeah, the month of August named after him. The idea of someone being August is still the greatest compliment you can pay to someone in politics. He was everything.
Yeah, he was.
So there were many official accounts written of Augustus by primarily Suetonius, who wrote about his appearance like this. He said, "Unusually handsome and exceedingly graceful at all periods of his life. He cared nothing for personal adornment. He was so far from being particular about the dressing of his hair that he would have several barbers working in a hurry at the same time. And as for his beard, now he had it clipped and now shaved, while at every time he would appear either reading or writing something." Even while they were cutting his hair, he was reading or writing. "He had clear, bright eyes. His teeth were wide apart, small and ill-kept. His hair was slightly curly and inclined to golden. His eyebrows met. His ears were of moderate size. His nose projected a little at the top and then bent ever so slightly inward. His complexion was between dark and fair. He was short of stature, although Julius Marathus, his freedman, says that he was 5 feet 9 inches tall."
Which is pretty average.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's quite an impressive-looking person compared to the shit that came after him.
Yeah, it's
amazing. You think about Caligula and Nero.
I mean, they always depict a younger man, but there's always this air of ageless majesty about him. He's got this look because you don't really see the eyes.
He never referred to himself in any dictatorial tones, and he lived in a relatively modest quarters. But he did amass supreme power. He was so wealthy from Egypt, as an example, that they referred to him as the first emperor. He never officially did that, but they did.
Augustus' body was laid on a pyre, or a crematorium, next to the mausoleum, which he was eventually buried in. Once the bier was in place, all Rome's priests marched around it, followed by the equites, who were the knights. Then the Praetorian Guard circled it at a run and threw on the pyre all of the triumphal decorations, often valuable silver or gold plaques any of them had received from Augustus in recognition of acts of valor. Centurions lit the pyre, and as the flames rose, an eagle was released and flew up into the sky, as if bearing Augustus's spirit to the heavens. A former praetor, presumably a man with an eye for the main chance, solemnly swore that he saw the spirit of the princeps on its journey upwards. By the way, princeps, The word prince comes from that. It just means first among equals. That was the only title he accepted, princeps.
Princeps.
Julia Augusta rewarded his sharpness of sight with a huge sum of 1 million sesterces. Perfume was thrown onto the fire, as well as things that the dead man would have enjoyed, cups of oil, clothes, and dishes of food. The ghosts of the dead, the manes, liked to drink blood, which invigorated them. This may have been supplied by gladiators who were often hired to fight at funerals. When the fire had burnt out, wine was poured over the embers. A priest purified those present from the taint of death by sprinkling water over them with a laurel or an olive branch, and the mourners were then dismissed, each of them saying, Vale, as he or she left the scene. Eventually, only one person was left behind the ashes, Julia Augusta, widow and now daughter of the dead princeps. The old lady remained where she was for 5 days. Then, attended by leading equites, who were barefoot and wore unbelted tunics, she collected the bones and lodged them in the mausoleum.
Incredible account.
Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I've been to the house that he supposedly lived in on the Palatine Hill.
Yes. Yeah,
and it's a simple little building. Yeah. You can still see some of the wall mosaics and murals that were obviously there during the time of Augustus, and that's called the Domus Augustana. And it's a very simple little place. Mm. It's not a palace. You know, later on, Nero had the Domus Aurea, and you had all these people who had these enormous, great big palaces.
Well, they had the ego, but not the intelligence.
And this guy, he just did not want people to treat him like a king, even though he was more than a king. CliffCentral.com